Welcome to Clap with Jane Clap. I know some of the most interesting and inspiring humans that are helping to keep humanity afloat in their own unique ways, even in the middle of a crisis. I want you to meet them too. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Clap with Jane. I have Dr. Jennifer Mullen here, and she's in New Jersey, right?
Yes, I am.
I can't believe that I get to connect with her during this time, because if you were looking at her face the way I am right now, you just honestly feel this like hum come in, like this warmth come into your body. And I guess those are all my favorite people. All you have to do is look at them and you can see right into their hearts or their spirits just by looking at them. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about Dr. Mullen. Her work is really important and incredible. But first, if you haven't heard of her yet, let me tell you. Dr. Jennifer Mullen creates spaces for people and organizations to heal, pronouns she, her. She believes that it is essential to create dialogue to address how mental health is deeply affected by systemic inequities and the trauma of oppression, particularly the well-being of queer, Indigenous, Black, Brown people of color. Dr. Mullen has earned her doctorate of psychology in clinical psychology from the California Institute of Integral Studies, a master's in counseling and community agencies from New York University Steinhardt School of Education, and her Bachelor of Arts in psychology and elementary education from New Jersey City University. She notes that her dissertation, Slavery and the Intergenerational Transmission of Trauma of Inner City African American Male Youth from the Cotton Fields to the Concrete Jungle, has been a primary foundation for her current work in furthering emotional wellness on a larger collective scale for communities of color. Dr. Mullen is currently a full-time psychologist at New Jersey City University's Counseling Center, facilitator for the campus LGBTQIA+ support group, coordinator of the university's nationally recognized peer education program, Peer Educating Peers, instructor for graduate counseling courses, and a proud LGBTQIA+ Gothic Knight Ally Safe Zone trainer. She has almost 15 years of experience in clinical practice, higher education, teaching, and grant writing. She is passionately committed to solidarity work that effectively addresses inequities based on race, gender, class, ability, gender identity, and sexual orientation. Her professional research and clinical interests include complex and intergenerational trauma, group psychotherapy, LGBTQIA wellness, spirituality and mindfulness practices, racism as trauma, healing in therapeutic settings, self-love as a revolutionary act, the process of decolonizing mental health. So, Jennifer, you are working really hard right now to support folks during COVID-19, and thank you for your energy, because I know you're working really hard right now. I met you when I was in New York. I think it was almost a couple years ago.
Yeah,
when I was teaching the Movement for Trauma program, and it was a big group. And there's always a couple people when I'm in the room when I'm teaching, where I'm like, to stay grounded, I just know to orient to certain people. And it was an intense couple days. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on in the room, and I just remember like, I could just look over at you and I'm like, okay, I'm doing okay. Because I could see your face and I could see you nod. And I'm like, okay, I'm on track. So, So that was my first time meeting you. And here we are now.
Thank you, Jane. And I'm like hearing that. It's just like, oh, I'm blushing. Yeah, because as I've mentioned before, but I feel like I need to say it again, your work has been so instrumental in helping me continue to grow as a psychologist and also as a human. Now getting into my body is like a mandatory, because I work with trauma so consistently and so often. I need to take breaks. I need to move my body. You just read about the peer ed group. Well, basically, that's a really nice way and fancy way of saying, like, I work with university first-generation college students that work on their shit, you know, that are willing to work on some really tough, grimy stuff like family dynamics and unconscious work and dream work. And we do retreats. And when I tell you, Jane, that these students know who Jane Clapp is.
Shut up.
No, really, they all follow you. And when I tell you that my students, we have Jenga pieces, and anyone that follows Jane, hello, we know that we need tennis ball, a plate, some Jenga pieces. And if you don't have that, then you have your arms, right? And then you have your sense that you can, you know, orient. Wait, what is it? Orient? Is it
orient?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They understand like flipping the lid back on, but, you know, I've taught them that, and they know all of this from you because I've learned it through you. So a lot of my students who live and grew up in the inner city and still reside there still use some of these. Like, I hand out tennis balls in my office like it is candy. Even my colleagues who think that, you know, quote unquote, they're above it, I come back and I'm like, no, let's try this, because they're so in their head and they're so anxious. And I don't want to just say they, because many, many days I can be as well. You know, I'm still a work in progress. I'm still learning. But thank you for everything that you continue to teach me. And thank you for, like, being such a grounding force also during the COVID-19 pandemic and throughout. I did your free webinar, workshop. Jennifer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really great. It was great to dance. And I've been trying to learn to do that, like, after client sessions, since I'm home throughout the day. So thank you for reminding us all to, like, be in our bodies and listen to our bodies. Because they'll let us know. Mm-hmm. And one more thing I need to say, because this is, I can't like stop singing Jane's praises.
Seriously. Oh God. Oh my God.
Yeah, I'm so grateful. And what I also learned, because I did the second workshop with Jane in Toronto, part two. One of the things that I really was always struggling with is, like, well, how do I listen to my body when, like, I haven't been able to trust my body throughout my life, right? Like, that has always been my feeling. Like, when someone says, oh, listen to your stomach, and when you're full, stop eating. And I'd be like, that
doesn't
feel safe, right? Or I don't know what that means. Or, or it'll tell me to keep going, or whatever it is. Like, pain doesn't stop many of us, like, with trauma histories, from, like, keep going, because we're used to it, or what have you, the conditions. But I have learned through that second training how, like, small little imperceptible shifts will tell me a little bit about how my body is doing, and that I might need to just slow down, and again, the orienting, or I might need to move in order to pay attention. And now what I'm noticing, and again, I'm using my words, not Jane's, really. Amazing.
Oh my gosh. I don't know. I don't know what words I use sometimes. I'm just trying to find words that connect for people. So whatever language you've come to means it's meaningful for you, right?
True. That's true. Yeah. But these acts, these movements, have allowed me to sound like, just yesterday I was doing things that I've learned through you, and they should seem really basic, but they're not, especially when we grow up with histories of trauma, right? And so I had client after client after client, person, you know, human after human, with a whole lot of anxiety. And here I'm thinking, I'm fine. And then I just did some, like, dancing in my room, and I just started bawling.
Oh.
Bawling. And I'm like, I don't know if this is mine. I don't know if this is theirs. I don't know if it doesn't matter, does it?
No, it's there. If it's in your body, it's there. It's real. It's like, and that's the thing. That's what you're saying. I don't know if it's mine, or I don't know if it's theirs. Like, that's the reality of what's in our body. That's the foundation of so much of your work, is that there's this idea that if we're suffering, it's ours, and it's somehow if it's ours and it's happening from inside of us, and mental health conditions are a function of something that's occurring or dysfunctional within us, versus, like, just us feeling into the fucking collective suffering. Yes. That is present now, or has been in the history of human suffering, particularly for the populations that you really try to serve and educate. So that's, like, the, on a microcosm, that's what you noticed in that day, but that's what's happening for so many people. And then we feel that anxiety and we think it's my anxiety.
Yeah.
And there's this quote. So my daughter, I'm like, okay, so I'm interviewing Jennifer Mullen. She's super amazing. And I'm trying to keep her occupied. She's very, she's been politicized from a very young age. And so she put together, she went through all your stuff on Instagram and she pulled almost 2 pages of quotes from you.
Oh.
That she said were absolutely amazing and powerful. She's like, I don't know what, because it's all powerful. And if you don't follow Jennifer on, on Instagram, you have over 53,000 followers. And that's because you're saying something that is the truth. Mm-hmm. And you have a way of condensing many complex subjects, challenges, issues, and problems, and you make it make sense. And this is a quote that my daughter Chase, that really stuck out for her, maybe even more so because of the crisis right now. Yeah. The raging inside of you is reflective of the collective chaos outside you. Your feelings are valid.
Thank you. Yeah, that's, I say that to myself very often. And it's perfect for what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like
the collective. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that article in the Calgary Journal, I believe it was, sorry. That it feels like, why hasn't this been published before with the same care, sensitivity, and thoroughness that article was published with? It wasn't super long, but that article went viral. Like, it was making its way through everybody in the trauma world. And that was, there were some quotes in there that were really powerful that came from you as well. And I think I'll just pull one up for us right now. We cannot separate the people and our lack of well-being or dis-ease, not disease. We cannot separate it from what is happening systemically. And that's sort of what you noticed in a microcosm in your body, right? You can't separate it.
No, no.
Why do we try? Like, why are people in the mental health community still, in your opinion, unable to lift their eyes up and look around and be like, this person is suffering not because there's a freaking biochemical issue necessarily in their brain. It could be caused by unrelenting stress and oppression. But why do you think people are so afraid to do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I love how you said afraid, because I think that it humanizes, right, the fear. And there's so much about my beloved field and feels. And I have to say that I'm a critical lover. You know, I'm not throwing like psychology or psychoanalysis or therapy under the bus. But I just feel like when I really love something, it is my responsibility to look at it and critique it and take the parts of it that I really honor and like do a mashup mix and undo and be part of change for parts that are just archaic and not working anymore. And because I have always worked with people on the front line, and because I was a kid growing up, right, who would be considered like historically disadvantaged or oppressed, and I was, and I could still be, part of what I realized is like, what does not work? And I think that oppressed populations have a bird's eye view of that. not that it's like, oh, we're always right, because that's such a generalization, but just more like, hey, if I'm always in fear, or if I'm always fearing for my life, or if I fear that I raise my hand in class and say this and everyone's going to turn around, you know, I'm just going to shut down, or it's going to put me in this kind of mode. When you're used to that level of stress, I just think that those are the folks that are very like well positioned to like listen to. So I started talking, if that makes sense, you know, I started realizing what was not working, and I started having a little bit more empathy. And so the fear piece comes in, right? I started paying attention to other therapists and talking to them, my friends, my colleagues, even people that I didn't agree with necessarily. Mm-hmm. And I say, hey, don't we notice that this isn't just pathology? This isn't just an individual. And I would get shut down right off.
No way.
All the time. And I still am. I still do, particularly, like, you know, quote unquote, in the real world, like particularly mm-hmm. offline. And when I'm sitting in these board meetings, or I'm sitting with three VPs and I don't even know their name, assistant, blah, 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 blah. They kind of just look past me and look past what I'm saying. And it's just like retention, retention, retention. And some of us, not just me, but also some white allies will say, yeah, but in order to quote unquote retain, mm-hmm. or in order to bring more money to the hospital, because that's what they care about, right? Mm-hmm. What we need to do is make sure that people feel connected, that people feel mm-hmm. well, that people have resources, that students have bus tickets to get to classes. Like, mm-hmm. Jane, majority of our student population do not have laptops and do not have internet access to do online classes. Mm-hmm. So how do we do mm-hmm. online classes? Mm-hmm. So that's the field. That's my field, you know, and I take responsibility. So I think that we were trained. I'm going to change that. We were conditioned. Mm-hmm. We were socialized. We have been socialized, and therapists continue to be socialized to fall in line. And we're not taught this. It's not obvious. It's not like, hey, work for us, work for big business, and don't care about the students or the people or the clients or the what have you. We think we're going into this with open hearts, open minds, wanting to help and serve, which is mm-hmm. why I have so much compassion for other people in my field. But we are consistently socialized like the rest of the world is mm-hmm. until we wake up and start educating and uneducating ourselves. We're socialized to think that, you know, mental illness is an illness, you know, this very mm-hmm. medical model, and that people are quote unquote problems or part of the problem, and that we just need to shift our thinking and our perspective. Say some affirmations, and I love affirmations. No shade. I have a bunch of them on my wall everywhere. Mm-hmm. But just this is going to be enough. You know, mm-hmm. self-care is going to be enough. And the mm-hmm. reality is, no, man, it's not.
Well, like, if we think of mental illness for basically, like, decolonizing therapy is about looking at it, a lot of mental health struggles as injuries. Yeah. Injuries to core self. It's not a disease, it's actually a habitual harm done to somebody mm-hmm. that starts to pile up in a way that creates an epigenetic expression of potential underlying illness, or just over time that acute stress over a certain period of time wears down our mental and physical resources and leaves people heavily injured.
Yes.
And I don't think that, I think we think of that only applies to people with acute trauma histories, but the way that people define trauma does not include oppression. And I don't get that. And I feel like this is what pisses me off sometimes, is the idea that to be a good therapist or analyst or counselor, that you have to be apolitical. Mm-hmm. That you cannot let your politics expose themselves to your clients. Mm-hmm. And I have a bit of an issue with that, because I think that's what you came across, you know, in terms of funding and keeping retention. And, like, yeah. I do not think, and you've said this before, that you can work in mental health and not be political.
Absolutely. Absolutely. People are literally dying in front of us all the time. And mm-hmm. If we're therapists, right, we know, or any kind of healer, body worker, social worker, we're seeing past just like how someone's putting it together, right? We can see and feel that the trauma, like eating away at a person, their fear, their overwhelm. And for me, sitting in a room and acting like this blank slate, and I can see where that can come in handy. I just want to say that. Mm-hmm. I think there's room for everything, you know, there's mm-hmm. room for all different kinds of theories. But for me and the people that I have come across and I serve, including some of our white brothers and sisters, just acting like I'm this sort of non sexual, non-political, right? Like this, like a Barbie doll with the mound. Like there's nothing, you know, like I'm not my gender identity, that I'm not any of, like, I don't have any feelings, and I'm just gonna have a white room and I'll let you like project what you want. And that can be helpful if you're doing psychoanalysis and that's your thing, great, you know? Mm-hmm. But if people are not purposely going to therapy for that, and they're going because they feel like they're emotionally dying, or that they can't handle it anymore, or that they're having panic attacks every day, or they're self-injuring themselves, or they've just been assaulted, which is like my normal day, hearing that all day, then I feel like people deserve to know who is giving them feedback and who is holding space for them and who is holding a mirror up to them. Mm-hmm. And so I've been educating some of the people that I serve on that, especially people right at or below the poverty line, because I think that what happens is there's this belief that people that are quote unquote, air quotes, like, you know, poor, mm-hmm. poor in resources are poor also in education or wisdom. And we know that that's not true. Mm-hmm. And that's not even true in terms of resources. Like some of the hardest working people I've ever met in my life are quote unquote poor, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, they're working 3, 4, 5 jobs and they're still not making the living wage, you know, mm-hmm. minimum wage might be this, but the living wage for them and 2 children may be $34 an hour in New York City, or maybe $40. And how can they make that? It's near impossible. So I feel like part of our jobs as therapists, as psychologists, social workers, body workers, is to also arm that very, very purposely arm our people that we're serving and working with also with the skills to advocate for themselves, the skills to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, learn how to appropriately argue and take issue with something happening at their child's school, which is a big issue all the time with parents, right? Mm-hmm. When their child is being discriminated against or given all these labels because they're black or brown child. So yeah, for me, Jane, I think that part of what our duties are to come as full people to the people that we're serving. Mm-hmm. Imperfect, I say that all the time, and allowing for the people that we serve to be able to work out some conflict resolution with us, you know. And if it's okay, I'm actually going to share something that happened a few months ago with somebody that I'm working with, a coaching client through decolonizing therapy. And she was stressing how she didn't feel like our work was consistent enough, and that I wasn't able to like kind of be there in the way that she needed. And going into it, right, I'm thinking all my ego shit is up. Right?
Oh God. Yeah, totally.
Right? All my stuff is up, and I don't have to get into all of that, but it's just like, well, is it like, all, even like, this isn't really all on me. Like, so although some of that may be true, there was a part of me that was also like, hey, I hear what she's saying too. And wow, I've been able to create a container with her where she feels safe enough to send me this letter rather than, oh, this is, and it could be some projecting. I'm not saying it's not at all, but this is only projecting. She's resistant to treatment. She did it like everything. You're the problem, rather than what does this bring up in me? Let me look at my shit first. Like, what does this bring up in me? Oh, my good little girl doesn't like it. She wants to be loved by everybody. Right. Oh, wait a minute. I already want to move on with her. Maybe this isn't the kind of person I want to work with. Let me check myself. Let me look at both of us and how both of us are being colonized to think like this is what therapy should look like. Maybe that's what's happening. That we're thinking like, because I'm being human and saying, hey, I'm still in traffic. I can't make it. You know, I can't afford an office right now. I don't have an office. So we're doing Zoom all the time. And so when we were able to have that conversation in a very gentle way, and of course, therapeutically, both of us just ended up crying, you know, both of us ended up tearing. Both of us ended up having just this deep love going back and forth, saying, oh, wait a minute. Oh my gosh. All my other therapists have been white. They have had a very like structured, almost rigid frame. You are bringing so much of letting me know what's happening and why things aren't working or they are. Like you're telling me this, I'm not used to being included in this because this isn't what my parents did. You know, and this isn't what my past therapist did. And I took a step back and I asked her, well, how does that feel for you? And she's like, liberating and scary as fuck. And I was like, okay, I'm on the right fucking path.
I love it. Love it.
Maybe we're doing something right. Because I mean, with decolonizing or politicizing therapy, you know, the systemic whiteness, right? Like the system always has me thinking I'm wrong. Always.
So you learn to question yourself first. Like, what am I doing wrong? If this isn't working, what do I need to fix about myself? And now you're trying, now you're like, you can take a look up and be like, this is showing up because it's part of the collective, right?
Yeah.
And it's showing up in this room with this person in this moment because we are living with the impact of the ideas or ideals of how we think we should be recovering, how we think we should be feeling better. Like sort of the whole 10 session CBT model, right? I don't know. Right? Like after 10 sessions of cognitive behavioral therapy, you should be on your way.
Yeah.
Right? On your way to being a productive human being again.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And the pressure that puts on people too. Right? Like, oh shit, it's session 8. What if I still want to work with this therapist or this healer? Oh shit, or I should be better. I should be further along. And for me, CBT, although I still sometimes use it, sometimes I'm talking about black and white rape, black and white thinking, magnification, like all the time. I feel like traditional therapy as it stands, in my humble professional and personal opinion, as somebody who's been in therapy for like probably 25 years of my life, literally, mm-hmm. different kinds of therapies, I can honestly say that I feel like it's a great foundation. Right. Mm-hmm. Like traditional therapy, I think can be a great foundation, and I would not be where I am today, nor would decolonizing therapy would be where it is today if I didn't really understand my theories pretty well and know how to apply them and know how to navigate with people in front of me. You know when the trauma is so compounded and so thick and so choking and taking up all the air out of the room that it quote unquote feels like a personality disorder.
And then
I'm not going to show as much of myself right away. Okay. Then I'm going to move in this way and allow that person to expose more of themselves to me so they feel safer. Okay. You know, like I do think it's important, and I need to say this, that, the therapists, body workers that we do understand and respect, the brain, you know, that we do understand the vagus nerve, how it all connected. I do think it's so important that we understand these connections. And the same attention and focus we pay to what's inside, you know, like the brain and the body, there needs to be the same exact, if not maybe a bit more, focus on what is happening on a micro level externally around us, you know? So, and I think I may have learned like a lot of this from you in the sense of how are we going to stabilize a person when they're still in the same place and it's still receiving the same amount of trauma. Mm-hmm. So they're going to come to me, they're going to feel a little better, they're going to be vulnerable and exposed, but I'm sending them right back out there and they may be dealing with the fact that, okay, maybe I'm going to get shot when I walk out the door, or maybe when I go to pick up my child, I'm going to get hit by my ex-partner and they'll be at the school as well. Like, so I hear that my clients say this on a daily basis. They may not use the word that many of us use, you know, but I hear them all the time saying like, okay, well, Jen or Dr. Mullen, whatever they decide to call me, you know, like you're telling me to do A, B, C, and D, but I'm still going to go back in the home with the abuser, you know? And I think that part of the work is not just being like, well, then leave the abuser. I mean, clearly that's part of the work, but you know, how do we get the person to a place where they feel like the abuser is no longer internalized? Either.
Right? And then also restoring agency. It's all about if someone decides to stay in whatever situation they're in, like that's their exercising of free will. Does that mean that they aren't getting better because they're choosing? There's so many different reasons why people need to choose a certain type of suffering.
Yes. Yes, Jane. Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Do you remember the moment when you realized that you had reached the end of more traditional therapies being enough to really pull? Because you are so alive. Mm-hmm. You're so full of life. You have so much, I don't want to sound cheesy, but light and energy and power in you. And I'm sure that it was hard earned over a lot of hard work. Do you remember the moment where you're like, fuck this isn't enough, I've reached the end of this this, the way you're living wasn't enough, and that type of therapy you were doing was only going to take you so far.
Yes, I do. I remember it very clearly. And what a beautiful question. And it's that I can feel me shift, you know, I can feel in a good way. No. This is, I love talking about it, but I think it's so important. So at that time, so it was a clusterfuck. I love that word.
So good.
It was a clusterfuck. It was like all these situations. And I honestly, truly feel that it was like my guides, my ancestors, people that came before me, all funneling and saying, here, we're going to make this so fucking uncomfortable, so unbearable that you're going to have no choice but to look up and be like, oh, you know, like we're going to make this so fucking uncomfortable and put so much pressure on you that you're going to realize the very crap that you've been, and it's not crap, but the very shit that you've been like learning about and decolonizing your brain about and all these undoing racism trainings and all these LGBTQ equity trainings. Like, cause I would sit there like, this is good, but this is all missing something. This is good, but this is, and I thought everybody felt like that. And maybe they do, but I was just like, this is good. Okay. I'm learning this. And I felt hungry. And I was doing all this stuff. And there was this deep emptiness still inside. Right. And I remember going to, all of this is happening, right? The storm is brewing. Mm-hmm. And, I was just getting sicker and sicker and sicker, right? Mm-hmm. Like physically sick. And, I was working with a therapist who I had for like 10 plus years. And she also, stepped outside of the normal frame, you know, and I'm not going to name her because I don't want to put her. And that's the thing, the fear always of being in trouble.
Right.
And she was outside of the frame and she was more like a spiritual teacher in many, many ways. And I love her very much, even though our time together is over at this point, for 10 years, she was my rock. And I remember going in and she looked at me and she goes, cause she had that rapport with me. She's like, you look like the walking dead. You look like a zombie. Do you feel like one energetically to me? And I was like, I have nothing left. I'm so tired. And one of my students had just been shot, innocent bystander. So that particular day I had a student call me from the ER saying, I'm literally waiting. They haven't seen me for an hour and a half, Dr. Mullen, but I didn't want to lose my slot. It makes me choke up just freaking thinking about it. I don't want to lose my slot with you. Right. And they're in the ER bleeding and no one is taking them because it's a predominantly Black area. Right. And they're like, okay, whatever, you know, whatever. And the student is like, please. I know I was sick last week. I'm in the hospital now. I'll get a nurse to get on the phone just so you know that I'm not lying. And I'm thinking, this is what our fucking system has done to our people to think that, like, if you miss two sessions, you're fucking done, right? Like, so I'm sitting, like, I'm chewing on this, and I'm like, my dear, don't you worry about it. Do you need me to go to the hospital? And my boss is looking at me like, you can't go to the hospital. That's not appropriate. You have 8 other clients. And that's a moment. I'm like, I don't give a fuck. Like, this is a human. This is a human that's afraid of losing their session. They're in a traumatic response. They're probably in this, like, fight or flight. This is how they hold it down, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking to myself, they need another human. And I'm like, who are you there with? Oh, my sister's going to come after work, but if she leaves now, she's going to lose her job. Like, you can see,
my God. Right? Oh, my God.
Yes, Jane. Like, all these layers. And I'm holding all of this. And you know, I had other sessions, very, very heavy situations. Another young woman that just came in. Literally, this is all one day. And this is that moment. So when I got into that therapy session as the Walking Dead, I just finished dealing with that. And actually the student was like, please don't come. I don't want you to see me like this.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, you know, so I did what I could over the phone. Mm-hmm. I asked to speak to a nurse. Of course, I used my doctor status. And I don't feel bad about it, I have to admit, but I was a little more aggressive. A little bit of my rage came out. And I said, if you don't bring that 19-year-old baby, that child in there in the next 10 minutes, we're calling like OSHA or something. Like, I lost it. I was totally like, and she was like, yes, doctor. And I'm like, right now, like the child has been bleeding out for, because again, I just feel like Black and brown children are not also humanized. And like when they're kids, even 18, 19, come on, they're still, I was 18, 19. I had a curfew. Like my mom was like, you're my baby. I don't care. I'm still my mom's baby. But I say this to say, like, they're not seen as children. They're seen as like adults and like, you know, like you're grown or you're problematic or what did you do to get shot or what have you. So that plus a young woman, trigger warning, that was very brutally assaulted, came into my office in the dorms, and three other people that had no food to eat and I had to bring them down to the pantry. Like, it was one of those fucking days, you know?
All in one day.
And I probably had had hundreds of days like that. And this is, I work at a university counseling center. So this isn't even community mental health, although it is, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're their first connection. Most of them are like, therapy, what? I'm not going to therapy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the people I work with. They're like, therapy doesn't work for me. Or what if my mom finds out? What if my mosque finds out? What if I'll get killed, you know? So I go to my therapist's office and I'm just looking at her and I can't even cry. Like, I want to, but I don't, you know, like that feeling. Yeah.
You're like a little numb. You're like, it's just too much. It's too much. You shut off.
Yes.
Oh yeah. You can't feel one more thing.
Not one more. And I think I'm sitting there. I kind of felt like I was floating. And I laughed because I'm thinking back and I'm like, I've gotten very close to these moments. Even as close as like last month, you know, I get close to it again. And then I'm like, nope, the system is wearing me down. Nope, I'm not going to work this hard. I'm taking 2 days off, mental health days. Nope. Like, you know, I get close to it. And she says to me, if something doesn't change, if, you know, you're going to not be alive much longer. And she said it very bluntly and lovingly. And just like, I said, yeah. And she says, what are you here, born here to do? Because that's what we were kind of talking about. I kept saying, I feel like I'm supposed to birth something. And I feel like it's stuck in my fucking badge. I'm glad you're laughing.
Oh my God. That's hilarious.
Yeah. And that's what it felt like with my dissertation. I would always feel like, oh, just like I want it out. It feels like it's right. Get it out. And I've never, you know, birthed a physical child, but I imagine that's what it feels like. A lot more painful. But, so, and that's how we've been working on. I said, I can't keep doing this. I can't keep doing a 9-to-5. I can't keep doing therapy also that doesn't see the whole person. Like, I can't keep just listening to old advisors that literally said to me, hey, therapy does not mix with politics. Stop it. Like, literally.
I can't even.
Literally. And this is in like a very progressive California school that where everyone's meditating and using chimes and doing yoga in class, but yet they're like, stop mixing politics and therapy, Jen. So I was, again, conditioned, trained. I was getting all of us conditioned. This is what I do in my free time. I'm an organizer, but my job is I'm a psychologist and this is what I do. So to just wrap this up, I'm in this office and she just looked at me and she said, close your eyes. And at that moment, I'm like, I don't know if I can. She goes, okay, then look down, you know? I, even with her, after 10 years, I was like, I can't close my eyes right now. I feel like if someone's going to attack me or I'm going to attack somebody. It was both.
Holy shit.
You know? And she goes, I want you to just close your eyes. And she asked me what kind of work I would be doing, what kind of therapy I would be doing. And I was like, it wouldn't even be therapy. And she's like, okay, tell me about it. And I'm like, It would contain the whole human. There would have pieces of somatics and pieces of psychodrama and piece of, all the stuff was coming out. I don't even remember half of it, literally. But afterwards, she tells me this is what happened. Because literally, I dissociated on some level. And she's saying, what do the people need? What are people begging you to bring, Jennifer? I think it's like time. And then I'm at that point, then I start sobbing. And I was like, I need to create liberating spaces where therapists are humanized, where colonization is more than just a metaphor, where we realize that intrapsychically, neurobiologically, socially, that we have absorbed so much of the pain and the joy and the wisdom of our ancestors. That it's like in our, like it's literally shifted our DNA, like, you know, literally. And I want to create something where like emotional dis-ease and environmental stressors are like, are combined. And we're actually seeing the impact of oppression on our bodies and systems where I don't have to fight to prove that this is what's happening to people.
Yeah.
And then she asked me some other great questions that I don't remember. And when I finally opened my eyes, my crying was that of like, I felt like I went through this like birthing process, like some energetic part of me died Mm-hmm. And I was like, that's it. Like, I'm mm-hmm. never, ever. Because I already do the work I do at the university. It's just behind closed doors. You know, like, my students know me on some level. I mean, they don't know everything about me. But if it's appropriate, then yeah, they know I'm divorced. Yeah, they know that I have trauma history. They might not know the details, but I can identify. Yeah, I've gone through some very heavy things. I feel you. So I just decided to no longer live. And again, I just want to say it is a process. And some mm-hmm. days I still very much am back into those places. Mm-hmm. But that moment, I thought, I don't have to do it this way anymore. Mm-mm. You know, and I thought, little young Jenny, you know, thought that getting a doctorate was going to free me. Uh-huh. From the oppression and being treated a certain way and the pain and the heaviness. Like, I really did think that. I got a doctorate because I was good at school, but also because some part of me thought, like, when I'm a doctor, it won't feel like this. Mm-hmm. You know, not everything I say won't be questioned anymore, or I won't be, you know, overlooked or skipped over in class and have a white woman say the same exact thing I said, maybe a little bit more succinctly, and it be heard rather than me being heard. So in that moment, I just realized that I was on the verge of a miracle and mm-hmm. that, you know, which to me is a shift in perspective. I'm a student mm-hmm. of A Course in Miracles. So for me, it's just, like, you know, a shift in perspective, which is just like, oh my gosh, I can choose to see this differently. You know, mm-hmm. I can choose to bring the beautiful parts of therapy that allow people to be messy and energetically bloody in front of us mm-hmm. and connect that with how this has occurred throughout our lineage and our times, how mm-hmm. it still occurs now, how it's real, that it's not made up, mm-hmm. it hurts just as bad. And those invisible wounds are just as throbbing and bleeding out. And I want to normalize mental health, you know, and mm-hmm. I mean, all of it, you know, and I want to bring in our ancestral piece, and that intergenerational trauma is ancestral trauma. And we can go back to our wisdom, and that our ancestors had something right. We need to rest a little bit more. We need to, you know, mm-hmm. we need to make space for those that do not have. And so, yeah, I want to say that I walked out of there and I had the best day ever after that, but I didn't.
But it was that time, it was that moment when you're like, I am not voluntarily participating yeah. in a system that does not see the whole person. And you know, that word,
yeah.
the phrase biopsychosocial lens gets thrown around a lot. But you know, I was in a class with a psychiatrist recently, and he was teaching about schizophrenia, and he was talking about the etiology of schizophrenia. And I said, okay, well, I have a question, because we had a moment for questions. I'm like, why are African Americans 5 times more likely to get diagnosed with schizophrenia? And he's like, I've never read that.
Sorry.
And I'm like, what? I'm like, well, yeah. And he's like, no, the etiology of schizophrenia doesn't say that. It's not dependent on race. And I'm like, okay. And at that moment, I'm like, do I keep talking? Because he's a kind man.
Yes, yes.
He does good work. He likely has saved lives in his work. But there's this, like, block to people wanting to see that, like, mental health is not just a brain disease. Like, yeah. it is a disease of culture and society yeah. that is often created unnecessarily by people living unconsciously or cruelly.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I'm feeling really pulled to yes, yes, yes. And I just got this sense, this deep feeling that it's important to also say, when you asked before, like, why are therapists or mental health professionals sort of like, what's that block? What's that fear mm-hmm. Of moving in this way? I think it's also, again, the fear collectively to really acknowledge and deal with some of the guilt and the shame that you know, many people don't want to look at, you know, and I want to say that, and it's not just white people, right? Like, you know, it's also people of color that are very much conditioned by the system. Like, we don't want to get uncomfortable, you know, like, and none of it, most people don't, you know, but I think it's like the people at the bottom, the people that are poor, that are migrants, indigenous, black and brown, many, not all, are so used to being uncomfortable that it's like, wait, it's And so I hear this all the time with my clients too, even now during the time of the corona, many, many of my clients are like, yeah, it's stressful, but how much more stressful that we're used to this? Like,
Jesus.
I've been locked up.
Sorry.
I'm just locked up in my house. Like, and I'm just like, and my response is that shit is real. Yep. It is. Uh-huh. Like I'm like, okay, you know? And so that's the thing is like, I think that we're so uncomfortable. So many of us, collectively talking about like systemic racism and slavery and, you know, what has been done to First Nations and Indigenous folks. And we talk about it, but in these like little pockets, and we're like, okay, this is contained. This is a workshop. I'm not going to be like kind of called in. And I don't really believe in calling out. I believe in calling in where we're like, let's have a conversation about this. And this is how it made me feel, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that dealing with the guilt and the shame for many people that identify as white, like it's so, ooh, like it's so big. And I can feel it sometimes in some of my clients where mm-hmm. I'm like, I can feel like where this is really uncomfortable, but I think that this is like where we need to go. Mm-hmm. You know, in order for you to not hold this anxiety, we dive into it slowly, mm-hmm. lovingly, you know, can you then realize that on the way out, it might actually give you so much space if we unpack mm-hmm. some of this anxiety? And usually they want to, but it's like not knowing how to, mm-hmm. you know, and me realizing that I always don't want to lead every white person through that path either. You know, like as a person of color, sometimes I need to like pull back. But yeah, I don't know if this is making sense or if I'm.
Yeah, it reminds me of that thing I was asking you about before we hit record, and that was the Canadians. So I'm in Canada, if people don't know, but like to think we're less racist. Mm-hmm. So we're less racist culture or society than the U.S. Yeah. And it's pretty funny. Like to think that we're doing so much better than the U.S. for goodness sakes that way. But you were up here in Canada speaking mm-hmm. in a town called Peterborough.
Yes.
And you were also in Toronto. And I mean, what did you, if you don't mind me asking, yeah. like, what was it like to be walking around a small town in Canada?
To keep it real, although my hosts were so gracious and so kind, and it was a university campus, and I felt really comfortable on the university campus. Mm-hmm. I felt so not comfortable in yeah. Peterborough. The wonderful, I can't think of the word I want to use, the person driving the van from the airport. Uh-huh. Peterborough, mind you, it was at like 9:30 at night. It's starting to snow. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's no lights on the road. Like, we clearly passed the Toronto city limit.
Oh, no.
And he's like, it's just me and him in this big van. And he's like, why are you going to Peterborough? Well, to speak, not thinking, you know, like, are you just like, oh, you know, to do a speaking gig, you know, and do a keynote and blah, 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 blah. And the Indigenous student group there, as well as the African Student Association, invited me out. And he's like, oh, okay. And he says, you know, we don't really have like racist people the way y'all do in America.
He did not say that. He did not.
You know, and he was an older gentleman. Same thing. I wasn't gonna, but me being me, I was like, I don't know if that's necessarily true. I'm like, you know, there's different forms that it takes on. And he's like, yeah. And I'm just like, okay, you know, but while I was there, I had a really lovely little room overlooking this like lake there, and mm-hmm. it was like snowing, so it was really, really lovely to look at, and I appreciated all the scenery. But when I walked to the grocery store and to the downtown area, everybody was staring at me, and I know that I'm a tall woman, and I know but there's just everybody was staring at me, and I'm like, okay, wow, this is really awkward. And this one woman, this is way before the COVID-19, was like literally keep stepping back and grabbing her purse.
Come on, did not. Yeah. I you know, I can completely see that happening.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And the fact that your driver said we don't have.
Can't make it up.
I can't believe it. And yeah. Literally within 24 hours, you're like, uh-huh.
Yeah. 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 And I thought to myself, well, this is good for me to experience. And this is must be what some of the students that are bringing me out. This is the reason they're bringing me out, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. And if I experience this for 2 days, this is what they're experiencing all the time. Even if the university seemed comfortable, quote unquote, I could imagine all the underlying shit that they probably had to deal with, all the covert and overt racism, you know, even from their own classmates, I came to hear about and understand more. But although I love Canada and the parts that I've been, I probably wouldn't go back to that little nook in Ontario.
Holy shit.
But I do like Toronto a lot. I do like Toronto a lot from the bits, but I've really only gone for your workshop and I haven't been like there longer periods of time. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all over the place, you know, in Toronto, but I like my little pocket. You know, I'm feeling like we need to find a way to leave people with something in the middle of all this mess and suffering and crisis. Is there one thing that what's happening right now, like makes you realize about yourself and your strength? Like that you have in you, given everything you've been through, given all the years of therapy you've done to be where you are right now, like, are you being brought into deeper awareness of something about yourself that you're like, thank goodness I have this in me so it can be with me right now through this time?
Yeah. Another beautiful question. There's a few, so I would say one of the top things is during this time, I'm really, really grateful that I've learned how to be alone. Mm. I know that sounds really maybe silly. I think the way that my trauma history went down, like being around people was always a way to not have to like slow down and not have to have like the shit come up. And so for me, it had been a bit of a journey. I think that to label it, you know, like codependency was just the way that I grew up, you know, witness my mother and father, that's who they are, you know? And I was in an 18-year marriage. And so I think stepping out of that a couple of years back and really going on the journey of learning to be with self, you know? Not lonely, but alone, you know, and being able to stand all of the stuff in me, the stuff that I don't always like. I think a lot of us have that about ourselves, but also being alone as a woman of color, as a cisgendered Black Afro-Latina, you know, that really would sometimes feel like scared for my life alone, you know, also, you know, as a, you know, a cisgendered, you know, femme woman, I would oftentimes feel very like scared, you know, like I don't want to walk down certain blocks and I live in a city and so on and so forth. And I remember the first month after my separation and having this place and being by myself, I would check every closet, not embarrassed to say it because I think it's helpful for people. I would get on the floor and look underneath my coats in the back. I would like triple check, and I'm on the third floor, like a renovated attic, but still, you know, like I would make sure all the windows were closed. Like there would be this, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I worked on this for so long. Why is this shit up again? You know, I need to learn how to feel safe. And do I feel safe in my own body? You know, do I feel safe? Do I trust myself to give myself what I need when I need it? So I don't know if that's too.
No, that's great.
But for me, learning how to be alone and to slow down and not be so busy all the time. And I think that some of your work and your workshops have helped me with that. Other people online and other like the NAP ministry. I remember when they were like 300 followers, and I've learned so much about the importance of particularly Black folks slowing down, you know, particularly people of color, people that have historically, like the United States, have been built on our backs, you know, and very little resources and finances and land passed down to us, how important it is for us to sit and rest. And that resting doesn't mean that we're lazy or we're good for nothing or that like, you know, we have lineages and lifetimes of our ancestors working to the bone. So I just feel like ancestrally and intergenerationally, that's been downloaded onto me too. you know?
And so that reoccupying your body is one of the, is a political act.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. Right? Like really reoccupying your body, and if you, in whatever way is possible, like actually being like, this is my body, and this is, I'm going to kind of decide what I take in,
mm-hmm.
you know, what I digest, what mm-hmm. I accept, in whatever way is accessible for people, you know. I hear that. I see that in your work and in every cell of your body, and I could just listen to you talk all day. I'm going to end on a light note and ask you, what are you listening to today or this week?
Oh, you mean like music or podcast?
Yeah,
or
music or podcast. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So actually, I'm going to pull up my Spotify and not cheat and tell you what I'm last listening to. Oh my gosh. 90 emo girl here.
Oh gosh.
To Hole, you know, Courtney Love.
Yeah. Yay. I know Courtney Love.
I was listening to some Hole. I really love that whole like Malibu album.
Oh yeah.
So I was listening to like a lot of 90s, Matchbox 20. And the other thing I was listening to was Juvenile, Back That Ass Up.
Sweet. We're gonna so put that song on now as soon as we get off.
I just feel like it's so good. Like everybody just wants to move to it, even if it's without rhythm. It's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're amazing. Thank you so much for your time. And every time during this crisis, I get to connect with a really good human. I'm like, it's going to be all right. In whatever way it ends up, I'm like, when there's people like you on the planet, you just make me feel like it's going to be all right on some level, you know? You're amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you for having me. Thank you for doing these podcasts. Your voice is so important. And I thank all the people that you're going to pull on. I just can't wait to dive in. So thank you, Jane, for being alive and being such a dope, amazing human. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much to Jennifer Mullen for her heart medicine during this crisis. And thank you so much to Jennifer Snowden, my first patron on Patreon. Thank you so much for supporting this podcast. If you feel inspired to support my podcast, visit my Patreon page. The link is in the show notes, or search me under Patreon Jane Clapp, or Clapp with Jane. 30% of your proceeds will be going to MSF, Doctors Without Borders.